and he sits down, kicking a second chair out with the toe of his shoe, inviting me to join him at my own kitchen table. "Where's Chris?" he asks, his eyes moving about the mess which is my home, the baby's paraphernalia taking up more than its fair share of space. Baby bottles litter the kitchen sink, stacks of diapers and containers of wipes on a living room floor, a heaping laundry basket pressed up next to the front door, something that smells shockingly like feces wafting from the garbage can. "Off to work already this morning?" he asks, trying hard not to wrinkle his nose at the atrocious scent. It's approaching 7 o'clock. "New York," I say, sliding into the chair beside him and catching the heavenly fragrance of his cologne, that earthy patchouli smell, blended with the intoxicating scent of coffee. I press the mug to my lips and inhale. Graham is dapper as always, his blonde hair spiked to perfection, his body cloaked in a fitted crewneck sweater and jeans. He says that he's been up writing since 5, as is the case most mornings. During business hours, Graham works as a freelancer, writing for websites, magazines, and sometimes the newspaper. But the early morning hours are reserved for his true passion, fiction writing. He's been working on a novel for umpteen years, his baby, his pride and joy, which he hopes might one day work its way onto a shelf at the local indie store. I've read bits and pieces here and there, an honor acquired only after 3 or 4 glasses of wine, after begging and pleading, after an exuberance of flattery and praise. It was good. What I read of it, that is. I hired Graham to tweak the wording on my nonprofit's website, to help with pamphlets, and to more or less write our annual appeal. Graham and I spent many late nights together, poring over that appeal, over a bottle or two of my now favorite Riesling, while Chris and Zoe were next door. I came home late, drunk, giddy, sensing no jealousy in Chris, as I most certainly would have felt if the situation were reversed. "What's there to be jealous of?" Chris asked, when I pressed him on it, something I never would have done in a sober state of mind. And then, the words that hurt the most, "I hardly think you're Graham's type." And I remember the look of satisfaction on his face, the gratification at saying those words aloud. I spent days, months, years wondering what those words meant. Not Graham's type, as in not the beautiful bombshell women who frequented his bed, who made the wall that separated our homes rattle from time to time, fragile baubles scooting dangerously close to the edge of a shelf. Is that what Chris was saying? That I was not good enough for Graham? That what I was the weathered woman next door, the one with brown hair being invaded by gray, with skin being annexed by wrinkles? I was the friend, the confidant, the chum. But I could never be more. Or maybe all Chris meant was that women were not Graham's type, that Graham preferred men. I would never know. But now, I sit across the table and wonder if in some other life, in some parallel universe, Graham could ever see me as something other than the lady next door. But inside, I can think of little besides Willow in the bathroom, running her fingers across the disfigurement on her chest. Teeth marks. Human teeth marks. And then she appears, as if beckoned by my mind, standing there in the hallway, and Graham turns his eyes and smiles, the most bewitching smile of all, and politely says hello. Willow says nothing. I can see her feet start to flee. But then she must settle upon that smile, warm and welcoming, entirely kind. And she smiles in reply. It would be next to impossible to see Graham smile and not beam. "Willow," I say then, "this is Graham, from next door." And Graham says, "How do you do?" "Fine," replies Willow, and then, "She's awake?" meaning the baby, and I say yes, that she is. Willow asks if there's more toothpaste, and I direct her to the linen closet at the end of the hall. She's gone for a split second before Graham turns to me, his eyes wide with curiosity, as if I've just given him the plot line of his next novel, and says, "Do tell," his brain making the quick connection between the baby on my lap and the teenage girl fumbling around in the linen closet for a tube of toothpaste. We sit on the L, side by side, and as we drive off, north this time, the baby becomes mesmerized with the motion of the train, the bright sunlight, the buildings that shoot past so fast that their colors and shapes begin to blur, red brick bleeding into reinforced concrete and steel frames. I sit close enough to Willow that our legs touch, and as they do, she pulls away instinctively, though on the crowded train there's nowhere else to go. Willow finds proximity with others to be disturbing, painful almost, in the way that she grimaces and recoils, as if my standing or sitting too close is as painful as a slap across the face. She'd prefer people to stay at an arm's length, literally, in that extra personal space, that space which she can't touch, and perhaps more importantly, can't be touched. She doesn't like to be touched. She winces at the slightest touch of a hand. She avoids eye contact as best she can. Is this the behavior of someone who's been maltreated, I wonder, staring out the corner of my eye at the erratic hairs she lets disguise her face, or the one who's mistreated others? Are the dark, shadowy eyes, and the way they leer at Chris and Zoe, at me, an effect of abuse, or an indication of her own dishonorable behavior? I watch as others watch the girl beside me, the one with a baby on her lap, the one whose eyes wander off into space, her mind teleporting her to some distant realm outside this crowded train, while I secretly stroke the toes of the baby with a single finger so Willow will not see. Are they seeing something I've failed to see? Are they plagued with some thought, some reservation that never crossed my mind? Or perhaps it did cross my mind, that reservation about Willow, and I chose to ignore it, as I chose to ignore the blood on the undershirt, to take her words at face value and not consider that it could be more. "A bloody nose," she'd said. And yet, in the time she'd been with us, her nose had yet to bleed. We take the train to a walk-in clinic in Lakeview. The baby's fever still lingers, lying in wait for the most inopportune times to rear its ugly head. Tylenol soothes her, yes, and yet it's only a temporary fix. We have yet to get at the root cause of the temperature, the discomfort that makes her miserable for hours on end. Zoe's pediatrician was out of the question. I knew that much. There might be questions. But a walk-in clinic where I could pay cash, that was much better. Much better indeed. We depart the L and walk the block or two to the clinic. A corner unit on a busy intersection that is loud at this time of day. Cars screaming past, sawhorses and caution tape blocking parts of the sidewalk that the April rain has turned into lakes. People step into the street to get around it, stepping into oncoming traffic so that some driver lays on their horn and beeps. Willow has the baby tucked into her coat, the army green coat with tufts of pink fleece poking out, a reminder of the day I first laid eyes on the duo, hovering at the Fullerton station in the rain. I offer to carry the baby, but Willow glances at me and says no. "No, thank you," is what she says, but all I hear is no, a denial, a rejection. My face flames red, embarrassed. And so I wait until we're in the vestibule, Willow and me, that quiet space between glass doors, to take the baby abruptly from her hands. So sudden she doesn't have time to react. She is unable to react because the eyes on the other side of the glass may see and say, "Well, say she's mine. It's more believable this way. Fewer questions." And I push through the second glass door and into the lobby of the clinic without waiting for her to respond. Willow lags behind, a half step or more, watching me, the flare of her icy blue eyes burning a hole in my shirt.
Willow. I'd never been out of the house, I say. That was the very first time. I tell Ms. Flores how Matthew appeared after Joseph and Isaac had gone for the day, how he had an old pair of gym shoes with him, with laces he had to help me tie, how he told me to put them on because where we were going, I couldn't go barefoot. I didn't know where he got the shoes. I didn't ask. I didn't ask where he got the sweatshirt, a thin hooded sweatshirt the color of tangerines that he helped me put on. "Where are we going?" I asked him, the first of three times. "You'll see," he said, and we walked right out the front door of that Omaha home. "You're telling me you hadn't been out of that house in, what, 6 years? Ms. Flores asks, doubtfully. She sinks a tea bag into a steaming mug of water, moving it up and down like a yo-yo, because she hasn't got the patience to wait for the tea to steep. Mama used to love tea. Green tea. I catch the scent of Ms. Flores's tea, and in an instant it reminds me of Mama, of the way she swore her green tea fought cancer and heart disease and old age. Too bad it didn't do anything to stop bluebirds from tumbling down the road. "Yes, ma'am," I reply, trying hard to ignore the way Ms. Flores's gray eyes call me a liar. "It was the first time I'd been anywhere, at least," I say, "other than the backyard. And even that was rare."
"Didn't you think it was a bad idea?" asks Ms. Flores.
My mind drifts back to the day that Matthew and I left the Omaha home. I tell Ms. Flores that the air was cold. It was fall. The clouds in the sky were thick and heavy. I can picture it still, that first day Matthew took me outside. "Yes, ma'am."
"Did you tell Matthew that? Did you tell him it was a bad idea?"
"No, ma'am." She yanks that tea bag from the cup and sets it on a paper napkin.
"Well, why not, Claire? If you knew it was a bad idea, then why didn't you say that to Matthew?" she asks.
And I feel my shoulders rise up and shrug. I remember that I walked close to Matthew, terrified to be outside, terrified of the way the trees shook in the wind, terrified of the cars that zoomed past. Cars which I'd only ever seen from my bedroom window. I hadn't been in a car since that day 6 years ago when Joseph and Miriam drove me to their home. For me, cars were bad. Cars were how Mama and Daddy died. Cars were how I ended up there, at Joseph and Miriam's home. I remember that Matthew tugged on my sleeve and we crossed the street. I peered back to see the house from outside. A house that was pretty almost. Almost quaint. It wasn't the newest house on the block, but it was charming nonetheless, with its crisp white paint and the black shutters and the gray stone that wrapped around the home. The front door was red. I'd never seen the home from that angle before, from outside, from the front yard. And then, for some reason, I got scared, and I started running.
"Hold on, hold on,"
Matthew said, tugging on my shirt to stop me from running. The gym shoes felt big and clunky, like 10-pound weights on the bottom of my feet. I wasn't used to wearing shoes. Around the house, all I did was walk barefoot.
"What's the hurry?"
Matthew asked, and when I turned to him, he could see the panic in my eyes, the fear. He could see that I was shaking.
"What is it, Claire? What's wrong?"
And I told him how I was scared of the cars, the clouds, the naked trees that shivered in the cold November air, of the kids who peered from behind curtains of their own homes, the kids with the bikes and the chalk, and their mean names, dickhead, retard. And that's when Matthew clasped me by the hand, something he'd never done before,
No one had held my hand for a real long time. Not since Mama did when I was a girl. It felt good. Matthew's hand somehow warm, though mine was made up of ice cubes. Matthew and I kept walking, down the block and around a corner, where he dragged me to a funny blue sign. "This is our stop," he said. I didn't know what that meant, our stop. But I followed him over to the sign where we stood and waited for a real long time. There were others there, too, other people hovering around the sign, just waiting. Matthew let go of my hand to feel around in his pants pocket for a handful of coins, and when he did, the cold November air whooshed up and snatched my hair. A car lurched by, with music that was loud and mad. I felt suddenly as if it was hard to breathe, as though I was choking on that raw air, like everyone was looking at me. "What you can't see can't hurt you," I reminded myself, and I pressed in close to Matthew, trying to forget the cold air, the loud music, the brassy eyes. A big bus, white and blue with tinted black windows, came to a stop right before us. Matthew said, "This is our bus," and we climbed up the huge steps with the other people, and feeling me hesitate, Matthew said, "It's okay. No one's gonna hurt you," before dropping a handful of quarters in a machine and leading me down the dirty aisle to a hard blue seat. The bus lurched forward, and I felt as though I was gonna fall from my seat onto the dirty floor. I stared at that floor, the one with an oozing soda can and an old candy wrapper and the gook from someone else's shoes. "Where are we going?" I asked Matthew again, and again he said, "You'll see," as the bus seesawed down the busy street, pitching me back and forth on that hard plastic seat, stopping every block or so to let more and more people on, until the bus nearly burst with folks. I did what I usually did when I was scared. I thought of Mama, with her long black hair and her blue eyes. I thought back to Ogallala, just whatever random memories I could bring to mind. They were few and far between these days, stuff like riding on the back of the shopping cart at Safeway, staring at an abandoned grocery list the last shopper left behind in the basket of the cart, the blue ink smeared across the page in a billowing cursive I couldn't read, with Lily tucked in the seat. I thought about biting into a ripe old peach and laughing with Mama as the juice dripped from my chin and sitting under that huge oak tree that nearly consumed the backyard of our prefab home, reading to Mama from books that were meant for adults only to read. "If you were so scared, why didn't you tell Matthew you didn't want to go?" I thought about that for a minute or two. I watched Louise Flores nibble a prepackaged shortbread cookie, and I thought about her question. I was scared for a whole bunch of reasons. I was scared about the people outside the home, but even more than that, I was scared about Joseph finding out we'd been gone. I knew in my mind that Joseph was at work, and that Isaac would be at school first, followed up by an after-school job, as was usually the case. But still, I wasn't so sure. And Miriam? Well, Miriam hardly knew when I was there, so she'd hardly know when I wasn't. But still, I was scared. So why didn't I tell Matthew I didn't want to go then? It was simple, really. I did want to go. I was terrified, but I was excited, too. I hadn't been out of that house for a long time. I was 14 or 15 by then. Getting out of that home was the third biggest wish I'd had for 6 long years. The first being that Mama and Daddy come back to life, and the second being to get Lily back. My Lily. I trusted Matthew like I hadn't trusted anyone in the past 6 years, even more than Ms. Amber Adler, who'd come to the home in Ogallala with the police officer to tell Lily and me that our folks were dead. As she kneeled down before me on the laminate flooring and with the kindest smile on her simple face, promised to take care of Lily and me and find us a good home. I never thought for once that she was lying. In her mind, she did just exactly what she said. But Matthew was different. If Matthew said everything was okay, then everything was okay. If he said no one would hurt me, then no one would hurt me. It didn't mean I wasn't terrified as we hopped off one blue and white bus and onto another, and then yet another, thinking of as many memories of Mama as I could possibly dredge up, Mrs. Dahl and her cattle, Mama's taste for banana and mayonnaise sandwiches, or the way she would eat all the way around the crust first, saving the insides, the guts, she called them, for last. Because thinking of Mama helped quash that notion of being scared half to death. "I love you like bananas love mayonnaise," she'd say, and I'd just shake my head and laugh, watching her prance around our home in her black shift dresses and beehive hairdos. That bus took us past buildings that looked like the apartment buildings I remembered from Ogallala. Short buildings splayed over the tawny lawn, made of pressed clay bricks, brick red. There were parking lots as wide as the buildings themselves, electrical wires running alongside the street, making the air through the open bus window buzz. We drove through slummy neighborhoods, past run-down, boarded-up houses, past ratty cars and rough-looking people who loitered along the cracked sidewalks. Just loitered. We passed American flags, flying in the stubborn wind, patches of dirt showing through the deadening grass on the side of the street, past bushes with puny leaves, brown and tumbling to the ground, and trees, naked trees, hundreds of thousands of them. There was an enormous parking lot that we passed with pieces of cars. When I asked about those cars, Matthew told me it was called a junkyard, and I asked him what's a person possibly to do with cars without wheels or doors.
"They use them for parts," he said,
leaving me to wonder what good wheels or doors do without a car. But I found myself searching for Mama and Daddy's Bluebird nonetheless, for the upside-down car, the smashed-in hood, the broken headlights, the mirrors that hung from the door by a string, bumpers and fenders squished down to half their size. This is the image I'd carried in my mind for all those years, a snapshot on the front page of the paper. I-80 crash leaves two dead. Mama and Daddy's names were never mentioned. They were called casualties, a word I didn't even know at the time. "Where are we going?" I asked for a third and final time. A smile flickered on Matthew's lips as he said, "You'll see."
"Where did Matthew take you that day?"
Louise Flores asks. I think of Matthew living in that house with me all those years that Joseph kept me locked inside. I wondered what Matthew thought about that, or maybe he didn't think about it at all because he had been a kid, and Joseph was his father, and he didn't find it the least bit strange. Living in that home with Joseph and Miriam had become commonplace to me after all that time. I had to look real far inside my heart to realize that being cooped up like that, it was wrong. I thought maybe it was the same way with Matthew. That was the way it had always been since he was a kid. He never saw Miriam come and go. He never saw me leave. And besides, Joseph said that no one would believe me, not a soul. It was his word against mine. And I was a child. A child that no one, besides him and Miriam wanted.
"Where did he take you?"
Ms. Flores asks again, and I say, "To the zoo."
"The zoo?"
she asks, like there's a million places in the world she'd rather go. And I say, "Yes, ma'am," with a smile on my face as big as the sun, because there wasn't any place in the world I would have rather been, except for maybe with Mama and Daddy. The zoo. I had been to a tiny zoo before, in Lincoln, but we'd never been to Omaha before. We saw antelopes and cheetahs that day, gorillas and rhinos. We went for a train ride, and into a giant dome that looked just like the desert inside, a real live desert. Matthew spent just about every penny he owned on me there at that zoo, buying me popcorn, too. I loved every minute of it. Though the truth of the matter was that I was a little scared of the people. Lots of people. I didn't know a whole lot about people back then. What I did know was summed up into the scattering of people in my life, and all of them packed into three categories: good, bad, and otherwise. It wasn't just that I hadn't been outside of that Omaha home for years. It was that I hadn't seen a whole lot of folks other than Joseph and Miriam, Isaac, Matthew, and, from time to time, every 6 months or so, Ms. Amber Adler. I stared at all the people we passed and wondered over and over again if they were good or bad, or if maybe they were otherwise. But Matthew held my hand tight the entire time,
He didn't ever let go. I felt safe when I was with Matthew, like he was going to protect me, though I knew that sooner or later I'd have to go home, back to Joseph and Miriam's home. As it was sooner rather than later, because Matthew said we couldn't risk Joseph getting home before us. We couldn't take a chance of him knowing I'd been gone. Because then, Matthew said, Joseph would be mad. Real mad. And then I wondered what he might do. That night, I dreamed of antelope. Antelope in a herd, running throughout the African savanna, free and uninhibited, as I only wished I could be.
Heidi. We're getting ready for bed when Willow steps into my bedroom and says goodnight. Her voice apprehensive in that way that it almost always is. Zoe is on my bed staring blindly at some sitcom on the TV, and I grimace internally every time someone on the screen says the word damn or hell, or a couple shares a romantic kiss, not quite certain when we graduated from the Disney Channel to this. Is my 12-year-old daughter old enough to watch this? To grasp the sexual innuendos and adult humor that suffuse the TV screen? But she stares blindly, not laughing along with the audience as some man slips on an icy patch in a parking lot, falling onto his rear end, a carton of eggs soaring from his hands and into midair. Her gaze turns to Willow as she enters, a cold-hearted stare in her warm brown eyes. She scrabbles for the remote control and turns the volume louder, trying to drown out the sound of Willow's spineless goodnight. Zoe is upset at me, upset that I forgot to pick her up from soccer practice, that I got sidetracked at the clinic with Willow and the baby, that she had to wait an extra hour, maybe more, with Coach Sam while he called and then called again my cell phone to remind me of my daughter waiting at Eckerd Park as the Chicago sun sank lower and lower below the horizon. By the time we arrived, her teammates were long gone, and Coach Sam had grown cold and antsy, though he faked a smile and told me it was all right when I apologized for the umpteenth time for my delay. Zoe didn't speak to me when we arrived home. She didn't speak to Willow. She showered and climbed inside the bed, saying that she wanted to be alone. This, of course, didn't surprise me in the least, and I could see in her vacant eyes, in the sulky expression that expropriated her face, that she hated me, as she hated most everything. I'd made it to that never-ending list that included math homework and beans and that nagging substitute teacher. That list of things she hated. Me. But the baby, on the other hand, was full of smiles, toothless smiles and mellifluous baby sounds that filled the room like bubbly lullabies. I clung to her greedily, not wanting to share. I prepared a bottle when she began to forage around in the pleats of my shirt for my breast, sneaking off into the kitchen without asking or telling Willow where it was that I was going, or asking whether or not it was okay to feed the baby, because if I did, she might suggest she do it herself. And then I would have to relinquish the baby to her care. And that was something I found I simply could not do. And so I stood in the shadows of the kitchen, feeding Ruby and tickling her sweet little toes, pressing a terry cloth dish towel to her mouth to catch the drops of formula that escaped, sliding this way and that down her chin like a pair of pinking shears. And then, "It's time for her medicine, ma'am," Willow declared, appearing suddenly in the kitchen, a bolt of lightning on an otherwise quiet night. I'd been caught, red-handed, with my hand in the cookie jar, or so they say. Her words themselves were benign, and yet her eyes bore holes into me there in the kitchen. She didn't have to say anything to make certain I knew I was in the wrong. I was fearful of Willow all of a sudden, fearful that she would hurt me, fearful that she would hurt the child. Her image, again, did an about-face before my very eyes. Helpless young girl with an affinity for hot chocolate. Teenage delinquent who'd managed to sneak her way into my home. She stood there in the kitchen, arms wide open for the baby's return. She was cloaked in yet another outdated article of Zoe's clothing. Jeans with a hole in the knee, a long-sleeved shirt that, on Willow, mutated into three-quarter length, peppering the lower half of her arms in goosebumps. The hairs of her forearms standing on end. There were socks on her feet, a gaping hole in one of the big toes. And as I stared at that toe, I found myself considering how naive I'd been to bring Willow into my home. What if Chris was right after all? Right about Willow? I hadn't paused to consider the effect it would have on my own family's well-being, for I was far too worried about Willow's well-being to consider Zoe, to consider Chris. What if Willow couldn't be trusted? My eyes flashed to the drawer where we keep the Swiss Army knife, hidden among a collection of junk. Birthday candles, matches, flashlights that don't work. And I found myself suddenly scared. Suddenly wondering who this girl is, who she really truly is, and why she is in my home. As she stood there, staring at me, she didn't ask the obvious. What was I doing? But she took the baby from my hands. Just like that. She just took her, leaving me helpless and short of breath. I stood in the kitchen, helping Willow dispense liquid antibiotics into the baby's mouth, and then stood horrified as Willow turned away with the baby in her arms. The baby I had just been holding, feeding. And without her, without Ruby, I felt as if something was suddenly lacking from my life. I watched as Willow settled cross-legged onto my sofa and laid that baby in her lap, wrapping her up in the pink fleece blanket like a caterpillar in a cocoon. I wanted to cry, staring at the all-but-empty bottle in my hand, the vacancy left in my arms. I found myself wanting, consumed by an impassioned need to hold that baby, my thoughts gripped by the image of Juliet being scraped from my uterus by a curette. It was hard to breathe, nearly impossible, as my thoughts dithered between a longing for that baby, for Ruby, and a longing for my Juliet who'd been discarded as medical waste. How long this went on, I don't know. I stood there on the threshold between kitchen and living room, hyperventilating, the carbon dioxide escaping my blood at an alarming rate so that my lips, my fingers, the toes on my feet begin to tingle, and I clung hard, knuckles turning white to the granite countertop, so I wouldn't faint or fall to the ground, imagining my body convulsing on the hardwood floors, envisioning Willow and Zoe standing by and doing nothing. Simply watching Sesame Street or some sitcom on the TV until I began to loathe them. The both of them, for this disregard, no matter how hypothetical it might be. And now I stand in my master bath, Zoe tucked in bed with the ridiculous show on TV as Willow utters her goodnight. She's made it all the way into the bedroom and stands, just shy of the bathroom door, watching as I hang my precious golden chain, my father's wedding band, from a shabby chic hook on the wall, a filigree bird painted a distressed red. I don't turn to Willow as I mumble goodnight, and wait until she's left the room to breathe. I slip into a satin nightgown, and locking the bedroom door, join Zoe in bed, sliding the Swiss Army knife under the pillow. I spend the sleepless night tossing and turning, trying hard not to wake Zoe from sleep. Zoe, who turns so that her back is in my direction, hugging the far edge of the bed so our bodies don't connect. Zoe, who used to long to climb in bed with Chris and me, who begged to fill that empty space between Mommy and Daddy's protective bodies, now pushed far enough away that she might fall off the bed. When I finally do sleep, my dreams are filled with babies. Babies and blood. They are not happy dreams of cherubs and cherubic babies, as I've had in the past, but rather bloody babies, dead babies, empty bassinets. I find myself running from room to room in my satin nightgown, searching for baby Juliet, finding her nowhere. In my dreams, I retrace my steps as if maybe, just maybe, I overlooked her lying in the middle of a room, wrapped up in her fleece blankie. I look in those places where the cats like to hide. In the closet, behind a closed pantry door, under the bed. She's nowhere. And then I peer down to find my satin nightgown slathered with blood. Like ketchup on a hamburger bun. It's on the nightgown, on my hands. And as I peer at my reflection in a mirror, aging 10 years or more older than I was when I went to bed, I see blood staining my once auburn red hair. I wake in a sweat from the nightmare, certain, absolutely certain that somewhere off in the distance, I hear a baby crying. I rise from bed and tiptoe across the room. The digital numbers on the alarm clock read 2:17 a.m. I find the hallway dark, save for the feeble light from the kitchen stove that wanders its way into the hall. It's quiet as I press my ear to the office door. There is no sound. No baby cries. And yet, I was so sure. I lay my hand on the satin nickel knob and turn. Locked. I try again, just to be sure. My heart beginning to accelerate in my chest. I'm worried something is wrong on the other side of the door. As a million unwanted thoughts sneak into my mind, everything from Willow rolling over and smothering the baby to some madman climbing up the fire escape and fleeing with Ruby in his arms. I need to get inside that room. I need to make certain she's okay. I could knock on the door and wake Willow from sleep, making her open the door so I can investigate how secure the windows are and whether or not the baby is all right. I could tell her I was worried that something might have happened to the baby. And if I am right, then my panic would be justified. But if I'm wrong... If I'm wrong, the girls, Willow and Zoe, the both of them, will think I'm insane. I scamper down the hall to the kitchen junk drawer, where we keep a collection of keys. For it's the kind of lock that simply needs to be unlatched with some sharp object. A paperclip would do. I return to the office door again, where I insert the makeshift key. Turn clockwise and voila. The door opens in a cinch. I turn the handle ever so slowly, not wanting to wake Willow. The door creaks open, and there I find her, as I did the night before, her back toward the baby, a pillow placed over her head. The baby is sound asleep, breathing blissfully. She's kicked the green chenille throw from her own tiny body and lies exposed so that I can see the rise and fall of her chest to know that she's alive. Not smothered in blood, as my dreams persuaded me to believe. She's sound asleep. Eyes and appendages completely dormant. Inert. I want to take her in my arms and carry her down the hall to the rocking chair in the living room. I want to hold her as she sleeps, well into the morning light, watching out the window as the first buses and cabs of the day appear on the city street. I want to watch the sunrise with Ruby in my grasp, to see the golden pink hues discolor the dark April sky. And then there are other thoughts that fill my mind. Thoughts of taking the baby where Willow cannot find me. I stare at Ruby, my body pressed into the shadows of the room, becoming a mere silhouette on the wall, a featureless shape backlit by the lightness of the walls, by the pale moonlight that sidles in from behind the pewter gray drapes, pin-tuck drapes that always looked a mess to me, wrinkled, puckered. I imagine myself as one of those famous iconic silhouettes, Jane Austen or Beethoven, or the trashy mudflap girls that graced big rigs and rednecks trucks, those girls with their hourglass shapes and enormous breasts. I place my hands on the wall to steady myself. I will myself not to breathe, so that I won't wake Willow, trying hard to extend the time between breaths until I become lightheaded and dizzy. There is a clock in this room as well, red digital numbers that drift from 2:21 to 4:18 a.m., all in the blink of an eye as I hover there at the foot of the sofa bed, wanting to cover the baby with the chenille throw, to move her, a foot or more from Willow's body so that I don't have to worry about her being smothered or squished flat. Wanting to lift her up and carry her from this room. But I can't, because then Willow will know, and she may leave.
Willow. In here we wear orange jumpsuits, the word juvenile stitched across the back. We sleep in brick rooms, two to a cell, on metal bunk beds, with heavy bars separating us from the concrete corridor where guards, tyrannical women with bodies built like men, stride all night long. We eat at long tables in a cafeteria, from chipped pastel trays loaded with foods from each of the food groups, meat, bread, fruits and vegetables, a glass of milk. It's not all that bad. Not when compared to picking food from the dumpster and sleeping on the street. My cellmate is a girl who tells me her name is Diva. The guards call her Shelby. She has plum-colored hair, though her eyebrows are a plain old brown. She sings all the time, all night long. The guards, other inmates, tell her to shut up, to put a sock in it, to shut her pie hole, calling the words out from places we can't see. I ask her why she's in here, behind the metal bars like me, sitting on the concrete floor because she swears her bed has been booby-trapped. But all she says is, "You don't want to know." And I'm left wondering. She's 15, maybe 16, like me. I see the holes where she was made to remove various piercings, the lip, the septum, the cartilage of her ear. She sticks out her tongue and shows me where it's been pierced. And tells me how her tongue swelled to twice its size when she had it done. How she couldn't talk for days. How some girl she knew split her tongue right in two when she did it. She claims her nipple's been pierced, her belly button. She starts to tell me about something that's been pierced beneath the pants of that orange jumpsuit, about how the guard watched as she was forced to remove the J-bar from her clit before locking her up in the slammer. And then she mutters under her breath, "Fucking dyke." I turn away, embarrassed, and she starts to sing. Someone tells her to shut her trap. She sings louder, high-pitched and off-key, like the grating brakes of a freight train coming to a sudden stop. The guard fetches me from my cell. She binds my hands in cuffs, then leads me by the arm to where Louise Flores waits in the cold room with the steel table. She's standing in the corner today, peering out the one window, her back to me when I walk in. She's got on a scratchy-looking cardigan, the color of smoke, a pair of black pants. There's a cup of tea on the table, a cup of juice for me. "Good morning, Claire," she says as we both take our spots at the table. She doesn't smile. The clock on the wall reads just after 10 o'clock. Ms. Flores motions to the guard to remove my cuffs. The male guard from the day before is gone, out of sight. In his place is a middle-aged woman, her gray hair wrapped in a bun. She perches herself where two walls meet and crosses her arms against herself, the handle of a gun peeking out of a holster. "I brought you some juice," says Ms. Flores, "and a donut," she adds as she sets a paper bag on the table. Bribery. Like when Joseph from time to time came home with a chocolate chip cookie from the community college's cafeteria, wrapped in cellophane. So that later that night I wouldn't think twice about pulling that big old t-shirt I wore to bed
up over my hips, and letting Joseph draw the undies down my thighs. She sets her glasses on the bridge of her nose and looks back into the notes from the day before. Leaving the Omaha home with Matthew, riding the buses all the way out to the zoo.
What happened when you got home that afternoon? From the zoo?
She asks. Nothing, ma'am. I say as I reach into the bag and remove a donut. Double chocolate with sprinkles, and stuff it into my mouth. I was back home well before Joseph, I mumble. Well before Isaac. Miriam was in her room, with no sense of time or nothing. I made her lunch and started the laundry, so that later when I told Joseph I'd done laundry all day, there'd be proof of it. Laundry on the line. He'd never know it was a lie. She hands me a napkin, motioning to my cheek. I wipe at the chocolate residue, then lick my fingers clean. I guzzle the juice. I tell her how riding the buses with Matthew became more or less a regular thing. We didn't go to the zoo more than the one time, because the zoo cost money, and money was one thing Matthew didn't have. We went places we could go without money. We went to parks, and Matthew showed me how to pump the swings, something I'd forgotten since my days back in Ogallala. Sometimes we just walked up and down the streets of Omaha, past the big buildings and all of those people. And then one day Matthew took me to the library. I remembered how I loved going to the library with Mama. I loved the smell and the sight of all those books. Thousands of books. Millions of books. Matthew asked me what I wanted to learn about. Anything in the whole wide world. And I thought about it long and hard. And then I told Matthew that I wanted to know more about the planets. He nodded his head and said, "Okay, astronomy it is." And I followed Matthew as he waltzed through the library like he owned the place and took me to a bunch of books on astronomy, as he called it. The sun, the moon, the stars. The library was quiet, and in that aisle with the astronomy books, Matthew and I were all alone, tucked between the tall bookcases like we were the only people in the whole entire world. We sat on the floor and leaned against the big bookshelves, and one by one, I started pulling the books from the shelf and admiring their covers. The black nighttime sky all cluttered up with stars. Growing up without a mother, there were things I wanted to know but had no one to ask. Like why every now and again my body started bleeding, and I was made to stuff my underwear with wads of toilet tissue to keep it from ruining my pants. Like why I was growing hair where no hair used to be. And why parts of my body were getting bigger for no apparent reason at all. There wasn't one lady in my life I could ask. The caseworker was the only one, but of course, I couldn't talk to her about those things, because she'd want to know why I wasn't just talking to Miriam. Because every time Ms. Amber Adler came around, Miriam was taking the little white pills and acting almost normal. Almost. But Miriam was far from normal. All those questions were about the outside, but I had questions about the inside, too, especially about Matthew, and this whole strange slew of emotions I felt whenever he was around. I felt an urge to be close to him, and lonely when he wasn't there. I waited each and every day of my life for him to appear at the door once Joseph and Isaac had gone, feeling sad on the days he didn't come. I was seeing things I'd never seen before when Matthew came and got me out of that house. Beautiful women with rippling hair, the color of straw or cinnamon, or macaroni and cheese. Their faces fancy, dressed in wonderfully complicated clothes. Tall leather boots with heels, skin-tight jeans, pants made of leather, teal pumps, dozens of bangle bracelets flanking an arm, shirts with scoop necks, sweaters with holes where bras showed through the burgundy or jade or navy fabric. Women and men holding hands and kissing. Smoking cigarettes. Talking on phones. I owned one bra, slipped to me by Joseph with the last parcel of clothing, one that contained brown jumpers and cardigans that bored me to tears, when what I wanted were heels and bangle bracelets. I wanted to slip some see-through shirt over my one bra and let Matthew see. When Matthew and I lay down, side by side on my bed to read from the pages of whatever book he'd brought me, we lay close, our bodies fused together, our heads sharing the same lumpy pillow. Matthew would slant himself into the bed's headboard, his legs and torso curving their way around my own, his head angled toward mine, so we could both see the same microscopic words in the books. One of my favorites was Anne of Green Gables, a book I must have asked Matthew a million times to check out, and though I knew he must be getting sick of it, he didn't ever complain. He even said he liked it too. But no matter how much I liked that book, still, I'd find it hard to do anything but think about Matthew's hand grazing mine while turning the pages, his jeans brushing against my bare leg beneath the blanket, an elbow accidentally swiping my breast as he redistributed himself on the bed. While Matthew was reading aloud about Anne Shirley and the Cuthberts, I lost myself on the tone of his voice, the smell of him, a hodgepodge of moss and cigarette smoke, the shape of his fingernails, what it would feel like if he slipped those toasty hands up under my sweatshirt and touched my breast. It would be different from Joseph, that I knew for sure. Different from Joseph, whose teeth marks were singed into my sallow skin like the branding of cattle. Matthew and I would lie that way for a real long time, together on the bed. And then sometimes Matthew would sit up quickly, rearrange himself on the other end of the bed, as if we were doing something wrong. Ms. Amber Adler continued to come every 6 months or so. In the days leading up to her arrival, Joseph, with my help, would give Miriam those pills. Like clockwork, Miriam would start to feel better and get out of bed, and we'd air the Miriam stench right out of the house. I'd get to cleaning, and Joseph would appear with a brand new dress, and he'd sit me down at the kitchen table and give my hair a trim. And by the time the caseworker appeared in her junker car with her two big Nike bag, the house would smell lemon fresh. Miriam would be acting more or less normal, and hanging on the refrigerator door would be some fabricated book report Joseph typed up, my name printed at the top. "Did you write this?" Ms. Amber Adler asked, clutching the paper in her pretty little hand, and I lied. "Yes, ma'am." Of course I never wrote any book report. I never went to school. But Joseph looked at her as if it were the God's honest truth, and said how my reading and writing were coming along okay, but there was still the issue of my disorderly behavior, and Amber Adler would pull me aside and remind me how I was oh so fortunate to have a family like Joseph and Miriam, and that I needed to put more effort into my conduct and show a little respect. The caseworker continued to bring letters from Paul and Lily Zeger, and from my little Lily. Big Lily told me how Rose, Lily, was growing up so big, how she wanted to grow her dark hair longer and longer, how she'd recently cut bangs, how she had so many friends, Peyton and Morgan and Faith, how she loved school, and what a brilliant child she was, and how her favorite subject was music. She asked, "Did I play any musical instruments? Did I like to sing?" She'd tell me that Rose, Lily, was a natural musician. She wondered, "Is it a family trait?" As Lily got to reading and writing herself, she would send me notes, too, scribbled on stationery with a simple tree branch and a red bird on front. The stationery had her very own name printed across the front, Rose Zeger, and every fall, tucked inside, was a brand new school photo. My Lily was always happy, always smiling, and in those photos I saw how she was growing older, looking more and more like our mama every day. When I looked in the mirror myself, I didn't see any traces of Mama, but I saw them on little Lily. In those photos that Joseph forced me to tear to shreds once the caseworker had driven away. I started to feel relieved for Lily, I tell Ms. Flores. "Why is that?" she asks. "Because Lily was happy with the Zegers. She was happy in a way that she never would have been if she'd have stayed with me." I thought of Joseph doing with Lily what he did with me, and just the idea of it made me want to bash his head in with a frying pan, the kind of thoughts that more or less started filling my mind as I grew from an 8-year-old child to a 15-year-old girl, one who knew with absolute certainty that Joseph had no business coming into my room. "Why didn't you tell the caseworker about Joseph?" asks Ms. Flores, adding, "if what you say is true," implying that it was not. I look away, refuse to answer. I've answered this question before. "Claire," Ms. Flores snaps, her tone dry. And then, when I don't answer, she goes on, looking at her notes instead of me. As far as I can tell, Claire, you didn't do a thing to remedy your situation. You could have told Ms. Adler what you claim Joseph was doing to you. You could have informed. She peeks back at her notes to make sure she's got it right. Matthew. But you didn't. You chose to take matters into your own hands. I refuse to answer. I lay my head on the table and close my eyes. She slaps a blunt hand against the table and I jump. The guard jumps. Claire! She barks. I will not raise my head. Will not open my eyes. I imagine Mama holding my hand. Hold still and it won't hurt so much.
Young lady, she says, you had better cooperate. Ignoring me will not help a thing. You're in a lot of trouble here. More trouble than you can possibly imagine. You're facing 2 murder charges, in addition to...
It's then that I lift my head up from that table and stare at her, into Ms. Louise Flores's gray eyes, and at her long silver hair, the scratchy cardigan, the wrinkles of her skin, the big teeth like a horse's. The gray brick walls of the small room come closing in around me, the sunlight through the one window suddenly in my eyes. A headache arrives without warning. I imagine a body, blood, bowels unintentionally let loose on the floor. The front door open. My legs wobbly like jello. A voice telling me to go. Go! And I think, two?
Chris. That baby is whimpering in the background when I finally get a chance to talk to Heidi. I ask Heidi what's wrong, but all she says is, waiting for the Tylenol to kick in. And there's a vibration in her voice, a jostling effect as if she's bouncing that baby up and down, trying to amend the situation, to get that baby to shut up. Fever? I ask, typing away on my laptop. The securities offered hereby are highly speculative. I'm barely listening as Heidi tells me that the fever isn't so bad. She rattles off some number I couldn't recount if my life depended on it, and then goes on to tell me about their doctor appointment at the clinic in Lakeview. DCFS, I remind her. One quick, easy phone call that could make this all go away. But all she says is, "Not now, Chris." And then she's quiet. She doesn't want to hear my nagging about the girl and how I think it's utterly insane that she's still cohabitating with us in a space too small for 3, much less 5, or that this whole fiasco might land us both in jail. The shares are being offered without... She tells me about bringing the baby to the family practitioner at the clinic in Lakeview, how they said the baby belonged to Heidi in an effort to avoid any suspicious inquiry, and I thought of that. Imagining Heidi, at her age, with an infant child. It wasn't so much that Heidi was too old to have a baby, but that we'd moved so far past that, past diapers and baby bottles and all that crap. Apparently it didn't matter so much who the baby belonged to anyway, because all the doctor was concerned with was the baby's angry fever as they stood in the office, desperate for some elixir, for some potion to remedy the baby. I can hear in her voice that she's tired. An image fills my mind. Heidi's hair is a mess. She probably hasn't showered all day. It's likely stringy, like spaghetti noodles, as happens to Heidi when she hasn't given it a good shampoo. There are bags under her haggard brown eyes, big, fat ones to boot, swollen and sore. She's clumsy, I can tell. In the midst of our conversation, a can of pop misses the edge of the countertop and drops to the ground. There's a crash as I envision sticky brown liquid seeping into the hardwood floors. Shit, she snaps. Heidi, who never swears. I picture her dropping to all fours to wipe up the mess with a paper towel. Her hair falls in her face and she blows it away. She's a damn mess, desperately in need of a shower and a good night's sleep. Her eyes are erratic, a million thoughts running amok in her mind. The situation has taken its toll on my wife. Heidi says that she had lathered enough cream onto the baby's bottom over the past few days that the doctor hardly mentioned the healing red rash, After ruling out all other causes of fever, the doctor used a catheter to get a urine sample and diagnosed the baby with a urinary tract.